Welcome to New World Notes. This is Kenneth Doust.
Taggart!
Yes, sir?
I've decided to launch an attack that will reduce Rock Ridge to ashes.
And if you happen to live in Rock Ridge, or elsewhere for that matter, you may find yourself asking, is there a right to self-defense? Historian and legal scholar Joyce Malcolm addressed that question in a fascinating hour-long lecture at the University of Hartford on October 7, and will present part of her talk today. Here Malcolm addresses the meaning of the Second Amendment of the Constitution, you know, the one that may or may not affirm the right of individual Americans to keep and bear arms. But as usual, let's proceed by first going back a step. In the 1950s, it was as normal for boys to play with toy guns as it was for girls to play with dolls. I remember some of my guns still. I had at least two lever-powered rifles that would send a cork most of the way across the room. I had a golden all-metal P-08 Luger replica that didn't shoot anything, but did have several moving parts. The P-08 has to be one of the most beautiful handguns ever made. Though I'm told that on real ones, the trigger pull is stiff and nasty. I know they cost so much to make that, after losing World War I with Lugers, the Germans decided to save time and money and lose World War II with Valtair P-38s instead. There were cap guns galore. I remember buying rolls of caps, 5 for 10 cents, I think, in that small blue box. Back then, toy guns looked like real guns, too. Now that's verboten, by order of, I wish I knew how to say Consumer Product Safety Commission in German. It would be all one word, of course. My gunslinging days were in a blue-collar town in the 1950s. Later, I fell in with a bad crowd. Liberals, academics, registered Democrats, people with graduate degrees, young college professors. Full disclosure, I was all of the above myself. As a young man, I was decidedly anti-gun. Not that I knew more about guns at age 25 than I did at age 10. I didn't know any more. But the times and my environment had changed. The corporate-controlled media became uniformly, stridently anti-gun, sometime around the death of Kennedy. None of my friends was a hunter, or a skeet shooter, or owned a gun for self-defense. I didn't become anti-gun as a result of conscious thinking, reflecting, and study, the way I became anti-war. It's just that anti-gunism was a large part of the atmosphere I breathed in the liberal, educated, academic environment I lived in. Like nitrogen, I just absorbed it. Just like a generation before me, millions of decent, basically nice folks just absorbed the belief that blacks are intellectually and morally inferior to whites, and women can't drive worth a damn. Guns are inherently bad, like cluster bombs. Guns are evil. Guns cause crime. America has such a high murder rate because it has so many guns. That was the atmosphere I breathed from the 60s onward. So you absorb a value through the atmosphere, and you find it reinforced by the mass media. A footnote here, but don't the media glorify guns and violence? Yes, but step back and take a look. Guns and violence. Note how naturally "and violence" just flows, without thinking, after guns. Guns and violence, like law and order, apple pie and coffee, shave and a haircut, 2 bits. And in all the popular movies and TV dramas, who fires the guns? 2 types. 1, evil, nasty, no-good criminals and terrorists. Their guns do bad things. Or 2, policemen of one sort or another, agents of the state. They use their guns to do good deeds, sometimes killing the armed bad guys, sometimes arresting them without bloodshed. Guns in the hands of agents of the state, good. Guns in the hands of evil citizens and foreigners, bad. In the popular media, who doesn't have a gun? Normal people. They don't need a gun. The state will protect them, right? What happens when a gun does manage to get into the hands of a normal person? Tragedy. As often as not, somebody's innocent child gets killed. In the hands of the state, guns are a force for good. In the hands of citizens, guns are a force for evil and or tragedy. Think about it. Then throw away your TV. Let me just say that my studies led me to study guns, crime, gun control, and related matters. And I discovered that the truth was much more complicated than I had thought. I also discovered how little I knew about, even the basics about guns. What a gun is, how it works, how one kind differs from another. Here's an analogy. Suppose there are millions of people who share a very strong opinion about the conflict of Israel and Palestine. It doesn't matter which opinion they hold, just that they hold it strongly. Now, suppose that these people have no idea, or only a vague idea, of what the Green Line is, or what were the results of the Six-Day War, or what the capital city of Israel is. Indeed, Obama himself seems to be confused on this point. Or where the illegal settlements are, who lives in the settlements, who were Yasser Arafat, David Ben-Gurion, David Balfour, what happened in Sabra and Shatila, Lebanon? What's the difference between Fatah, Hamas, and Hezbollah? Imagine these strong opinion people either had no clue as to the answers, or else they confidently proclaimed a wrong answer. Now I know what you're thinking. Hey, how did you get to know my in-laws? But the point is, what happens when people have strong opinions based on almost zero knowledge or experience? Answer, nothing good. But how many progressives know any more about guns than your in-laws know about Palestine? How many of our fellow travelers can tell a bullet from a cartridge, from a magazine, from a chamber, from a cylinder? We keep hearing about semi-automatic guns. Apparently they're particularly bad. But what does the term mean? And why are they bad? You've heard over and over again how easy it is to buy a gun in this country. Okay, in your state, what steps would you have to take to buy a gun legally? What additional steps would you have to take to lawfully take that gun out of your house? We left-of-center types wouldn't dream of stereotyping people of color, gays, Palestinians, lesbians, Jews, the insane, women. But how do we picture hunters or NRA members? Do we know any of them personally? If not, how did we form such a clear picture of who they are? When we share a prejudice with our peer group, it doesn't seem like prejudice. It seems like common sense, or even truths self-evident. Okay, end of sermon. The congregation may wake up now. On October 7, noted historian and scholar of constitutional law, Joyce Malcolm, gave a public lecture at the University of Hartford. She spoke about gun laws, crimes, and the meaning of the Second Amendment. Her talk was titled, To Heller and Back, Is There a Right of Self-Defense? The speech had three main parts, and today we'll hear the third. Here Malcolm discusses the meaning of the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, as interpreted by the Supreme Court just a year ago in a landmark case known for short as Heller. Despite the claims of the gun banning lobby, the Supreme Court has never decided whether the Second Amendment guaranteed an individual right to own guns, or only guaranteed the states the right to arm the militia. Those who dislike guns tend to the latter interpretation. Gun ownership is a collective right, not a right of the individual citizen. We liberals said this, and legal scholars said this, and law textbooks said this. But guess who never said this? Right, the Supreme Court. Until Heller. And in Heller, they determined that gun ownership, in fact, is an individual right. That doesn't mean it's wrong to hate guns, and doesn't mean it's wrong to want to get rid of them all, if that's how you feel. But it does mean that the government may not outlaw gun possession by law. We're stuck with the fact, just as we're stuck with the Electoral College, freedom of speech, and giving Rhode Island as many senators as California. The Founding Fathers had no desire to deprive plantation owners of their slaves, and no desire to deprive citizens of their firearms. We can abolish private possession of firearms, the same way we abolished private possession of slaves, but we'll have to amend the Constitution to do so. Or rather, you'll have to amend the Constitution to do so. Count me out. In a minute, we'll hear Dr. Joyce Malcolm's lucid, interesting, and very witty talk on the meaning of the Second Amendment, and why the Supreme Court decided as it did in Heller. But first, let's catch some practical, if tongue-in-cheek, testimony by yet another Canadian singer-songwriter, Fred Eaglesmith.
stole last night right out of his driveway. We heard the dogs a-barking, we never paid him any mind. And Mary says she's gonna lock the door from now on when we go away. And I've been walking around this farm, wondering if it's time, time to get a gun. That's what I've been thinking.
Smith. Two quick notes. The Heller decision overturned an ordinance of Washington, D.C. that effectively banned possession of all guns, even in the home. The Second Amendment reads, "A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." A dependent clause, then the main clause. The first clause states why the rule is needed. The second clause states the rule. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Here's Joyce Malcolm.
I'd like to just briefly go into some of the arguments about the Second Amendment and its meaning. The language of the amendment is up there so that you can see it. People who believe that it's only for members of a militia consider it a collective right. A well-regulated militia being necessary to a free state. That's what it's about. So basically, it's a right for states to have a militia. Now, the Constitution spells out who has power over the militia. Almost completely belongs to the federal government, although it's organized by states. And the Second Amendment really doesn't in any way alter the balance of who has power over the militia. The other thing is that states have powers, but only individuals have rights. Anyway, there's this idea that the militia clause means that it's just a collective right for members of a militia to have a gun. Since the militia is now the National Guard, which in fact was a part of the Army, the old-fashioned militia is no longer there, and so the whole thing is obsolete. And I should say that while you may not realize it, you're all members of the unorganized militia. There is an organized militia, which is the National Guard, and there's an unorganized militia, which is all the rest of us. I had a colleague some years ago who taught at the Citadel, South Carolina, and it's sort of a military school, and all the faculty were in the military, they all wore uniforms. And since he wasn't in the military, he wore the uniform of the unorganized militia. And when the faculty members met each other, they saluted. So he said he got used to carrying everything in his left hand so he could salute with his right. There is this unorganized militia, and we have a uniform. I don't know, Connecticut may have its own, too. The other argument is that the word the people, the right of the people, makes it a collective right. It doesn't say the right of persons or individuals. It says the right of the people. That bear arms, the term bear, only has a military meaning, that, you know, if you don't, and that they don't like keep. Keep is very awkward. And so the way that they've interpreted keep is that it's part of bear. Keep and bear is a unitary term, which is military and has nothing to do with individuals. And then one of my favorites is the comma theory. There are two commas in this version. The different texts of the Second Amendment have different numbers of commas. There's a comma after state and a comma after arms. So the right of the people to keep and bear arms is within commas. The comma theory says that interpreting the Constitution, anything within commas can be eliminated. And so you can say a well-regulated militia being necessary to security free state shall not be infringed. I thought, I know it sounds funny, but this was very seriously argued by learned scholars. If you read the whole Constitution that way, God knows what would be left. You know, it would be an interesting exercise to see what the result would be. And then I should say one more theory. It was discovered by a legal scholar named Carl Bogus. So I call it the Bogus theory. I like to get him, you know. But the Bogus theory goes that basically the Second Amendment is in there to, because it was some kind of conspiracy between the northern states and the southern states to enable the southern states to control the black population, the slaves, by passing this Second Amendment. I mean, it leaves a couple of things, you know. First of all, there's not a shred of evidence for that, which upsets Bogus if you mention it. And secondly, there were slaves in the North, too. I mean, it's an interesting idea, but it really... And then this is a theory that actually one of the students I spoke to this afternoon came up with, too. And that is that the Second Amendment, being from the 18th century, only protects 18th century weapons. So if you have, you know, a blunderbuss or a black bass, and a Connecticut, was thinking, you know, this is the state for gun companies, right? The big Springfield, and the Colt are from here. If you had an 18th century weapon, that's fine. But, you know, it doesn't go beyond that. So these are the arguments that were made on behalf of Washington, D.C., for the Second Amendment not being an individual right. On the other side, you have evidence like James Madison, who said, and he had drawn up the Bill of Rights, the list of them, that these would relate first to private rights, that they were guards for private rights. He also intended originally that the Bill of Rights, each of them, be placed in the body of the Constitution and not at the end. And so where would he have put this Second Amendment? He would not have put it in the section that deals with the militia. Instead, he was going to put it in Article 1, Section 9, between Clauses 2 and 3, which I know you all know right off. So I'll tell you. It's immediately after a guarantee for a writ of habeas corpus and prohibition of bills of attainder. So these are things that are in the Constitution dealing with personal liberty, the writ of habeas corpus. That's where he would have put it. The only reason that they all got put at the end was that Roger Sherman, who was on the committee, decided it would be better if amendments went at the end, even though Madison said it would create more uncertainty, which it has in this case. So it got put at the end. Another point, the Senate, in going over the language of these rights, rejected an amendment that would have added for the common defense after the phrase to keep and bear. If that had put in, it would have been the right of the people to keep and bear arms for the common defense. If it had said the common defense, then it clearly would have had in mind as a part of some larger unit and not yourself. But they rejected it, so they left it as it stood. As far as the idea that the people means that it's collective, the same term is used in the First Amendment, your right to freedom of speech, freedom of the press. It's all the right of the people in the Fourth Amendment and the Ninth Amendment and the Tenth Amendment. Somehow only in the Second Amendment is that supposed to be a collective right. As far as bear, the Supreme Court themselves in another case said that to bear simply means to carry something. I mean, it can mean military, but it also lots of times means to carry. To keep, we all know what to keep means, and it means to have. So why is the militia in there, that clause? Well, I think that there was real concern about the fact that the Constitution includes a standing army, and there was a lot of fear about the power of an army, professional army, and there were no limits on the number of, on the size of the army, the number of men in it. In fact, near the end, Madison wanted to put in some fixed number. There were some of the states who sent in proposals for amendments wanted a two-thirds or three-quarters vote of both houses of Congress before you could have an army in peacetime. And the founders rejected that. But I think that they wanted to say that they really were dependent on the citizen soldier. And they felt that it was sort of a mark of dishonor to the army to say, and they've said that, mark of dishonor to the army, to say something that sort of showed a lack of trust in the army. And so they said that it was the well-regulated militia that was the necessary security of a free state, sort of leaving it at that. And of course, if you disarm the people, there would be no militia because you have to draw the militia from the people. The Heller case was decided in favor of there being an individual right, 5-4. It was very close, much closer than I think that the evidence for it dictated. Justice Scalia wrote the majority opinion, a long opinion. This case was decided the very last day of the term, and it was the very last case decided, so they kept everybody waiting. It was a, and then there were two dissents, one general one written by Stevens, who said that it was just a collective right, and one written by Breyer, Justice Breyer, who said that, well, it may have been true that Washington was less safe now after the ban than it was before, but it was up to legislators to strike that balance and not up to the court. And I'd like to just read you a little bit from Scalia's opinion and then close. First, he comments on Justice Breyer's idea that, you know, you should see what looks like it makes good sense. And I should say in this, I don't like to say too much about myself, but I just must share this. There's a very famous philosopher named Etzioni. He's a communitarian, right? And some years ago, he wrote an article that was in the Chronicle of Higher Education called The Irresponsible Gun Scholars, Irresponsible Liberal Gun Scholars. I was the only one named by name in it. And what he said was that if in investigating this topic, you actually found that there was an individual right, that it was the most responsible thing would be not to let anyone know that. Keep it to yourself. And he said, admittedly, this is, you know, no scholarship would be done if everybody looked to see what the repercussions would be. But then he said that if you found that there was an individual right, it would be like posting on the internet a recipe for making E. coli in your kitchen sink. I must say, I never responded to that because I assumed people reading it would realize that, you know, this isn't the scholarly way. But at any rate, his idea was that it was in the public interest that there not be an individual right. And basically, Breyer kind of takes that tone. So this is Scalia's view of Breyer's comment. He said, Justice Breyer arrives at his interest-bearing answer because handgun violence is a problem, because the law is limited to an urban area, and because there were somewhat similar restrictions in the founding period, which Scalia goes on to say was a false proposition that we've already discussed. He says the interest balancing inquiry results in the constitutionality of the handgun ban. So Breyer found that the ban is constitutionally okay because there was a good faith effort of the legislature and the council in Washington. And even if it didn't work, it was their right to try it. You know, there was no other way to ban guns than to ban guns, to get fewer guns. Then Scalia says, we know of no other enumerated constitutional right whose core protection has been subjected to a freestanding interest-balancing approach. The very enumeration of the right takes out of the hands of government, even the third branch of government, which of course is the courts, the power to decide on a case-by-case basis whether the right is really worth insisting upon. A constitutional guarantee subject to future judges' assessments of its usefulness is no constitutional guarantee at all. Constitutional rights are enshrined with the scope they were understood to have when the people adopted them, whether or not future legislators, or yes, even future judges, think that scope too broad. And then in some, he says, in sum, we hold the district's ban on handgun possession in the home violates the Second Amendment, as does its prohibition against rendering any lawful firearm in the home operable for the purpose of immediate self-defense. Then he concludes, we're aware of the problem of handgun violence in this country, and we take seriously the concerns raised by the many amici, these are all these briefs people sent in, who believe that prohibition of handgun ownership is a solution. The Constitution leaves the District of Columbia a variety of tools for combating that problem, including some measures regulating handguns. But the enshrinement of constitutional rights necessarily takes certain policy choices off the table. These include the absolute prohibition of handguns held and used for self-defense in the home. Undoubtedly, some think that the Second Amendment is outmoded in a society where our standing army is the pride of our nation, where well-trained police forces provide personal security, and where gun violence is a serious problem. That is perhaps debatable, but what is not debatable is that it is not the rule of this court to pronounce the Second Amendment extinct. And so they decide that the handgun ban in Washington must be overturned. Now, September 30th, they have agreed to hear a case of the Chicago statute that bans handguns in the city of Chicago, also a quite a violent city. It's called McDonald against Chicago. And presumably it will be argued, and we will hear in the spring, whether this handgun ban is constitutional or not, and whether the Second Amendment applies to the states and the cities. The fact that it was a federal ban, or in a federal district, in the Heller case, means that there must be a separate case to see whether a right is incorporated to apply to the rest of the country. Does not mean that you can't have various forms of gun control. It simply means that you can't have this kind of blanket ban. There's been a conflict in the circuits. The Ninth Circuit, which Kosinski sits on, has changed its mind about the Second Amendment. They've decided that it was a historic and a terribly important part of American history. Before that, they were ready to toss it out. Now they've agreed with Supreme Court, and they say it applies to the states. But in Chicago, when the Chicago law came up before the appeals court there, that circuit decided that the Heller decision did not apply in Chicago and that the Chicago gun ban was constitutional. So because there's this conflict and it's really an important issue, the Supreme Court has decided to hear this case right away. So, you know, basically just a little over a year after the first one, they're going to make it clear about the Second Amendment applying to the cities and states. I think that almost surely they will find that it does. And I'd just like to close, for those of you who may not be particular fans of the Second Amendment, with this comment by Sanford Levinson. He says, if the Second Amendment is not worth the paper it is written on, what price the first? I mean, if you can read out of the Constitution because you don't like it, a particular write or misinterpret it in some way, which is a lot easier than amending, then all your rights are in danger. Thank you very much.